Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you today?
Hi, Stu. I'm doing really fine today. How are you?
That's pretty good. It's a nice day. I did quite a few things today that I'm probably going to pay for it over the next couple of days, but that's the perils of you got a house, you got to maintain the stuff in the house and the yard and everything else, which, you know, don't get me wrong, I kind of like doing it. You know, it's fun for me, but it's time consuming. So, and then, yeah, inevitably, it seems like 2 days after the effort is when it hurts the most, but yep. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah. How about you?
I spent the entire afternoon with all my grandchildren and all three of my sons and their families. So I had a wonderful time today. I got to hug babies and little people. And my oldest grandson is 5. And he came over and he whispered, "Put your cheek down here, Grammy." And I did. And he kissed me on the cheek. And then I smiled and I gave him a hug. So I got like 30 kisses after that. Every so often he'd run over and he'd go, "Grammy, put your cheek down here." And I was all kissed up by the end of the day.
That sounds fun.
It was amazing. I cannot tell you there's anything in this planet I enjoy half as much.
Well, here's some news that'll make you a little bit happier. Since the last episode we put out, we've gained 3 more subscribers. So okay. I'm not really a number watcher, you know. And if it goes up or goes down, I mean, that's just, I look at the numbers, you know. And it would be nice if they, you know. I see people with YouTube channels, you know, with, you know, 50, 60 and a million subscribers, something like that. I don't know if we're going to get there, but yeah, you know, because we don't have the flashy stuff, but other thing. But anyway, if you are watching this on YouTube, please consider subscribing. If you're not subscribed already, click the subscribe, click the bell down below to be notified when we release new content. Click the like button, please. That helps us out too. We have 3 Facebook groups. One for me, that was the Paranormalist Podcast. One from the previous co-host, which was the Paranormalist Group Share. And one that you've had for quite a while is the Paranormal Asylum. And we also have the email address, paranormalist@theparanormalistpodcast.com. And I can't believe I got through all of that without screwing up anything. So if you can send us your ideas, your comments, whatever, we would be happy to have those, whether you do it through one of the comments on the podcast platforms or through Facebook or through email. We'd like to hear from you anyway. And like last week's episode that we did, that was based on a listener's suggestion. So we're always open to suggestions. If you look through the list of things we've done, there's a considerable list, but there's more out there. So I'm sure you have them. I'm sure you have the stories too.
And we are on Rumble. Am I not?
Yes, right? We are. Yes.
Mm-hmm. We're on Rumble as well. So please check us out one of those places.
I think we have 3 subscribers on Rumble now. I bet we just started there too. Although I have moved or I have copied over all of our previous content.
Mm-hmm. And for those folks who joined, thank you so much. We love having this journey with you. So, and now I guess I should tell you what we're going to talk about.
Yes, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wandered off of demons and devils and ghosts for a little bit and wandered into the UFO world for a while.
Oh.
So we're going to talk about UFO stories. Some interesting ones that I don't think people have heard. There's, you know, I think it's fascinating how every state in the United States has like a couple stories that are the ghost stories you go to, the UFO stories, the Bigfoot stories. And we don't ever get to look outside of our own country, really. I mean, it's rare. You get a TV show here and there. But the truth of the matter is there are UFO stories all around the world, from, you know, Canada to Africa to Europe to Asia. They are really amazing and they're interesting because you'll see correlations and you'll see things that are not correlated. And I decided to start kind of broadening out and checking out some unusual stories. So we're going to start today with a UFO crash in Brazil in 1996. And this is a fascinating story. When it occurred, the 3 young ladies it happened to were castigated by the public and by the military and the government and said that they were making up stories and what have you. So let's talk about the story of that really happened and then go through the process. So basically, it was January 13th of 1996, the United States Air Force contacts Brazil and says, "We've shot down an unidentified flying object and it is looking as though it's going to crash in southeastern Brazil. So we know that really happened. There is a record of that happening, both from the U.S. notifying them and Brazil receiving the notification. So 7 days later, there were two sisters and a friend of theirs. They were 14, 16, and 21 years old, respectively. And they live in a town, about medium-sized town in southeastern Brazil. And they're walking along through the backyard and along this alleyway. And they see this creature crouched down against a stone wall. It's not very tall. It's brown. Its eyes are three times the size of a human's eye. Definitely not a human. It's got either oil or sweat or something all over it. It's really hunched over, and it actually makes eye contact with them, and they get the very sincere impression it's terrified and it's suffering, as though the heat of this Brazilian afternoon is just, it's just too much. And the girls are scared. I mean, obviously they see this creature that's not in any way human. It's not like anything they've ever seen. So they take off running. They go home and they tell their parents, and the mother goes out to see what the girls are talking about. She doesn't find it, but there's a, it's been raining. So there's the ground there is pretty wet and mushy and spongy. And she can see an oily handprint. It's three fingers and a thumb on the wall, and little round marks that look like the feet, and the thing is just gone. So she calls the police, and they report this whole thing, and the police come out. They don't see anything right away. But before long, there are other phone calls about sightings of this creature and or a couple creatures. There's a little disparity there. So eventually, what happens is they send out some military to scour the area. They scour the area and discover these two creatures. There's a young soldier, he's in his early 20s, and he's the one that comes across the one of these creatures, and he pins it in a corner, you know, outside, like there's a brick area, and it's kind of pinned in because there's all these fenced in or bricked in yards in this little area. And he tries to get it. Well, it scratches him trying to defend itself. And he catches it, and they put it into a vehicle, and it's driven to a hospital. They discover a second one that is either dead or dying. And they get the distinct impression that the first one that they captured was pretty bad shape itself. Mm-hmm. And they split them up and take them to two different hospitals. Something else happens to them. They're taken from these two hospitals. And in the meantime, the police and the military are already starting a campaign to make out that the girls are liars. There is a police chief who actually does believe them. And he says, look, I've interviewed the girls and I really think they're telling me the truth, but the military steps in, and here's where it gets interesting. To explain it easily, there was a gentleman who was driving along the road. He saw the military and he got out of his vehicle to ask them what was going on. And they were told that they told him to get out or they would shoot him. And he's pretty, you know, he's incensed. He's a young man in his 30s. He's like, I'm just asking a question. What are you doing on somebody's private property? And, you know, and what's happening here? And again, the military starts screaming at him, get out, we're gonna shoot you. You understand, we're gonna shoot you. You can't go down there. And down there was the house where the creatures were eventually captured. And he would remember this, you know, of course, it's something you don't forget, military officers pointing a gun at you. So he comes out and he says, hey, these girls might be telling the truth. There was definitely something hanky happening down there. And there was a police chief, the police chief who interviewed the girls, who also would eventually interview this gentleman. He would interview some of the military personnel over the years, and he recorded all of this. And he kept it. He still has it to this day. Some of it he has released to back up the girls' story. Now the girls, you know, those were our young women. They're in their mid-30s, early 40s. And the years have gone by. And what they have come to learn through researchers going in and looking at this case is that what happened is the creatures were taken. They were taken to these hospitals where they were looked at, examined, and they were then taken by the United States military. There are eyewitnesses who say Americans in civilian clothing came in and confiscated not only the two creatures, but back at that house where they wouldn't let that guy go down and look, there was a cigar-shaped craft that had crashed, and there was debris everywhere. So this guy goes back the day after the whole event, and he's rooting around in this area. He comes across what looks like the skid marks, you know, where something's gouged into the earth.
Right.
And he can see that, and he finds these smaller pieces of aluminum foil. That's exactly what he describes it as looking like, aluminum foil. And it's kind of concave, it's bent. And he picks it up off the ground, and he scrunches it in his hands, and it immediately pops back into shape. And he's like, this is crazy. Within minutes of him getting there, the military descends again, and they force him to leave at gunpoint. And then they gather up whatever it is that they must have missed the day before in the rush. We know that this happened. We know there are now the doctors have come out and have said that they looked at these things. There, a young man that I said got scratched. We know his fate. He would end up becoming infected with some disease that the doctors couldn't recognize, and a few days later died of the disease. And this was a healthy young man in his early 20s. The doctor who treated him has gone on record as saying whatever was wrong with him was not a disease he had ever seen before in his life, and it did not respond to any of our drugs, including antibiotics. And it's not, he said, I don't believe this, whatever happened to him was of this earth. There's no way a single scratch should have done what it did. It's a fascinating case. And what makes it so fascinating is that so many of the people are still alive. They have traced down the driver of one of the two vehicles that took the aliens, if you want to call them that. I don't know what else you would call them. And he is hidden for 26 plus years. He won't talk to anybody. He's afraid. His son actually made arrangements with a crew that went down there from the United States to film a documentary called Moment of Contact. And even though his son attempted to get him to talk to these people because, you know, he needs to tell the story, basically, is what his son was arguing. The man came out and he told them, he said, he came to the window and he said, I'm going to tell you right now, if you don't leave, I'm going to shoot you. I don't want anything to do with this. I don't want to tell anything. I said, they threatened me. I can't say anything. So we now know that the girls saw them. We now know that there were three other witnesses who also saw them over the 7-day period between the time the first sighting of the girls happened and they were captured, whatever these things were. And we now know that there are people alive who say that they were investigated, that the military, the United States military was involved, that civilians came from the United States and took away everything. And we know there were some really interesting little things about it, like the doctor and the girls who found them, they all talked about an ammonia smell. They said when you got close to the creatures, and then for the young man, when you got close to the young man, it smelled like ammonia strongly. There would be one eyewitness who said it wasn't ammonia. She thought it was sulfur, but it was still a very, very strong smell when you put it all together, of something that has attempted to be hidden for all of these years. And now as adult women, the case has been opened again, and all these people are now feeling like it's a little safer to come forward, and they're starting to talk about what they saw, and there are videos that have come out. There, it's interesting because these young women were interviewed by the press at the time and then made fun of, you know. But the press interviews and what they say today are almost identical. Other people who had come forward and they didn't know about each other and had called the police and done interviews with the police, they described the same story. And this is long before all of this was public. So you have the girls doing the interviews and these other people calling the police, and they're all telling the same story, and nobody had published it yet. So it's a fascinating tale. And it's considered the Roswell story of, you know, Brazil.
The, and let's call them creatures. Okay. So since we don't know exactly what they were, if they were the pilots and or passengers of the craft, that would indicate some type of higher intelligence. They may have been pets of the whatever was in the craft. Okay. And who knows? And we will probably never know. You know, again, so more questions than answers. But anytime you hear something about this, that makes me a little bit excited, because I know that these beings probably didn't come from our own solar system. They came from another solar system. So that means that interstellar travel, number one, is possible. Okay, so faster than light travel is probably possible, unless you're going to spend years traveling at near light speed. So technologically, that's pretty cool. The fact that the U.S. military actually shot and downed one of these craft, whatever it may be, is almost incredulous. So that tells me that it can be done. Yep. And so that's that it would be vulnerable. I can't imagine an interstellar craft traveling at what speed crashing into the Earth. How someone could even survive that, you know, have no clue. But I just, yeah, the science of all of this, it is what really drives, that's what makes me completely fascinated. You know, because the fact that there's alien civilizations, that's all but proven simply because of the vast numbers of habitable planets that are out there.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case when you look into it. When you look at the timeline and you realize that there's like four different people telling the same, well, four different groups of people telling the same stories.
Right.
At different points to different people and using very similar wording, talking about the things looked sad, they were oily or they were sweating, they looked like they were in pain, they were miserable. You could tell if the girls were, that was the thing that struck them, is these things, whatever this thing was that they were looking at, it was hurting, it was suffering. And that's exactly how everybody else described them that saw them. They were suffering, which tells me that, you know, somehow or another that they, you know, whatever they were human, and they made a human connect with these girls because it lived with them. It's living with them to this day. They know that whatever these beasts, these creatures were, they were intelligent and they recognized that they were in pain.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe that the Earth's oxygen atmosphere is not good for them.
Yes. So now the next story I wanted to share is about Aurora, Texas. It is an oldie and a goodie. It's a chestnut. I don't know that it's very well known these days. But here's the story. So in 1897 in Aurora, Texas, there was a thunderstorm and a vehicle crashed into a local judge's windmill during the storm. And to everybody's shock, when everything cleared, they came out and found that far from it being a tree or something like that, it was a craft. Now, again, 1897. This is before the Wright brothers.
Yeah, I'm immediately thinking of the movie Cowboys and Aliens.
Yes, that's a great movie, isn't it? I haven't seen it before.
I'm sorry to distract from you there, but that's the first thing that went through my head.
I know when I saw the movie, that's what I thought of, because I knew this story. I've known this story since I was 12. I came across it in a very obscure book years and years ago. But anyhow, they find that there's creatures in this thing, and they're dead. Well, they don't know what to do. So, and there was a newspaper account from the time. Actually, you can pull it up on the internet and it'll show you the local newspaper wrote up, you know, the event about these strange travelers that fell from the sky and all of this. It's fascinating. And basically what happened is they didn't know what to do with them. So they gathered up the bodies and discussed it and decided, well, what do you do with a body? You bury it in the cemetery. Let's give these poor fellas from wherever they're from a Christian burial, which is the height of what they could have given them at that point in time.
Okay.
They didn't just want to throw them in the ground. So they took them to the local cemetery. They dug up a hole. They put the bodies in it. They didn't know what to do about a tombstone. So basically, they basically put a boulder up there, and somewhere in time, somebody chipped a circular spacecraft with little porthole windows into the boulder, which was similar to what the wreckage looked like. So now they have the bodies in the ground and they have this wreckage to clean up from the poor old judge's, you know, busted up windmill. So the judge's name was Judge Proctor. So they gather all this debris and they couldn't figure out what to do with it. So what they ended up doing was taking it to an old well in the area that everybody was trying to fill in with debris, and then they would cover it over and get rid of it. They dump it into the well and just other debris goes in on top of it. So this spacecraft or pieces of the spacecraft are now down in this well. Nobody's interested. Nobody cares. It made the local paper and that's about it, you know? And this goes on until the 1970s. It was kind of a local story. And then it got put in, you know, it made the newspaper from time to time. And then there was, remember those weekly reader books we all got whenever we were kids?
Fondly, yes. I do.
Yes, those, yeah. I loved them as well. So there was one of them that I bought years and years ago when I was like 12 or 10. And it was all these mysteries and unknown stories and what have you. It was in that book.
Oh,
and it just went boom. And everybody was reading it because their kids were reading it. And so it became popular. So fast forward to the 1970s. And it dawned on somebody, hey, we might be able to dig these guys up and see if they were like human or what they were, right? But somebody goes to the cemetery and they find out that it looks like somebody's been messing around. The tombstone, which was that big boulder, has been smashed and what have you. But a local person who does metal detecting runs a metal detector over that, and he gets 3 hits for pieces of metal inside that ground. So he says to his buddy, who's the reporter that's looking into the story, you know, going to retell the story. He's like, we should dig this up. Like, there's no laws against digging up space aliens. You can't dig up human bodies, but there's no laws against space aliens. And
makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's curious. Like, hey, I was just digging in there because I had my metal detector going. All they find in there is the next day when they decide to dig is one piece of pipe. But what they do discover is somebody dug it up over the night and took something away.
Hmm.
And all that's left in here is one piece of pipe. So fast forward again, of the 1990s, and it becomes of interest again because somebody's reading these stories and they go, hey, I wonder if there's any residue, anything there that we can still find that will help us. And it's interesting because, again, they in the newspaper account of the time, they talk about it being like aluminum foil, you know, the materials that are used for the craft. So they find out that the craft had been buried in a well. And nobody knew about it until this guy decides to uncap this well and redig it so he can get a new water source, because, you know, why would you start from scratch somewhere else when you already know there had been a well there, so there definitely was water. You're right. Going to clean it out and, you know, and use it. And that's when it comes to mind that that's where the spaceship went. They find parts of it, and then guess who shows up? But the strange people who gather up everything and take it away. And they're from the local government. You know how that goes. They're from the government.
We're from the government, and we're here to help.
Writing words in the planet. That's what I've always heard. So it's fascinating. So then they actually petition the cemetery association and they say, hey, is it possible for us to dig in there and just see what might be left, if there's any fluids or maybe body parts that were, you know, bones and stuff that were missing or what, something like that. They have absolutely refused to allow anybody to dig there at all. And to this day, nobody has ever dug there. And it's a fascinating story because nobody will let them. Why the town is so afraid to let them and why the cemetery association is, I don't know if it's because they, as they say, they believe that these beings should be allowed to rest in peace or not. But, you know, we have dug up graves for a whole lot less reason.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of threats and coercion going on. But
I do as well. I mean, that's standard fare in these stories. I'm gonna have to say.
You know, so, but that begs the question, what information is so, trying to come up with the perfect word for it, what information is that dangerous that if it got out, I mean, would society collapse? Would, just what would happen? I mean, would a calamity, would the, you know, who knows what would happen? But I mean, to me, there's got to be some reason other than we got to keep this secret. I mean, so there's got to be something that's, I hate to use the term, earth shattering. Yeah, but.
I have theories. And my theories are that the government, as it always does, it tries to turn everything for power, and that there might have been alliances made and or ways that they're trying to manipulate the situation for their own benefit.
Plausible. Yeah.
The argument was always made at, because of War of the Worlds and the radio broadcast. Well, we saw what happened with a fake story, so, you know, we can't tell the world. But we're not the same people. We're not in the same mindset as we were then. To them, those people in that day and age, the idea of aliens, you know, was earth-shattering. It wasn't presented as a normal thing. Today, we all watch sci-fi shows. We all go, yeah, we know the government's covering this crap up. We just, you know, can't prove it or whatever. So it's not the same argument. It doesn't work anymore. It just doesn't. And when the government started leaking the TikTok videos and all this, the world didn't come to a shattering end. They were like, yep, see, we told you. And that's all it is. So the rationales behind this, I suspect, are more nefarious. I don't have a lot of faith in government, and I don't just mean ours or somebody else's. I believe that people in high places want power, and they'll do so, and they'll do a lot to keep it. So that's where I am at, but that's my opinion. We're going to move on to another one in Zimbabwe.
Oh, okay.
This is a fascinating story, and I've been following it off and on for a long time. So it was September 16th of 1994. There's a school called the Ariel School. It was a school for 6 to 14-year-old kids, okay? And it was a very prestigious school where a lot of very rich children were sent. It was a private school. On that afternoon, there were 62 or so kids out at recess. And they're kind of hanging out playing when something goes shooting across the sky and crashes in a field, lands in a field near the school. One or more creatures dressed in black approach the children, get out of this craft and come towards the children, and telepathically communicate messages to them that they would later say, or at least were reported as them later saying, and there's a reason I say it that way, that they were environmental in nature. And if you remember, there was a time frame where there were a lot of abductees and encounters, third, you know, fourth and fifth and type encounters that came back with, they want us to protect the earth and blah, blah, blah. There might be a real good reason why that happened. And it may not be paranormal or scientific in nature at all. But anyhow, the kids go home and, well, first they tell the teachers and the teachers don't believe them. They're rolling their eyes. The teachers were not outside. They were all in having their lunch while the kids were out playing. So they missed the whole story. And So the kids go home, and you know, 2 or 3 days of there's kids with nightmares and telling these wild tales to their parents about aliens in black coming out of spaceships in the middle of the afternoon and interrupting recess. I mean, you know, it doesn't take long for the parents to start going, what the heck's going on? So the parents go to the school and they start talking and they're like, what's happening here? We don't get it. And the school just basically says, look, we didn't believe them, but you know, maybe there is some truth to it because there's a burn place over there in the field and the kids aren't shaken from the story and they're all pretty much telling the same story. So because the story happened in Africa, most of the people in the world didn't hear about it. You know, I hate to say it, but it's true. There's a bias and there's parts of this world where we just don't hear things that happen. You know, it's the same with China and Asia and places like that. We just don't hear them. We don't realize that Africa's not a country, it's a continent. There's like 54 nations inside of Africa. And there's a lot of history and stuff we just aren't educated on. So it just kind of got blown by the side of the road. There was a woman by the name of Cynthia Hind, who was a local UFO researcher. For her, it became a passion. She heard about the story. She started interviewing the kids and interviewing the teachers and looking for any physical evidence. And eventually in the UFO circle, there's a lot of stories that happen inside the UFO circle of researchers that they investigate that you don't hear about, sometimes ever, because it's just the nature of it. This is a story they can't prove or they keep it close to the vest for whatever their reasons. So it took a while, but eventually, there was a gentleman by the name of John Mack. He was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. He actually would get censured by the Harvard University for looking into UFO cases. And he had to go through all kinds of political interfaces to be able to write and talk about this stuff. He gets fascinated with this case. And he goes over to Africa, to Zimbabwe, and he starts talking to Hind and to another researcher named Tim Leach. And some of them had already, like Tim Leach and Hind had already done interviews and recorded the interviews with these kids and what have you. So now, you know, Matt goes over and he starts poking it in, asking questions and looking into this. And he's fascinated by the whole story. Here you have 62 children who basically are telling the same story. And interestingly enough, there was an adult man who from the other side of the field saw the same thing, who had called the police and had an encounter himself, unbeknownst to the kids. And this would eventually come out as the whole case comes together. And this is the case that actually gets him in trouble with Harvard. Because Harvard's like, you're putting too much energy into this and you're whacking out on these theories. And like, we want you to be a tenured professor who is paying attention to your job. And he was doing his job, but he was doing a lot of this on the side. And he wrote several books. They're fascinating books. So there's no doubt that something happened. There is some physical evidence, like I said, the burning in the field and all of that. There's an adult on the other side reporting it. 62 children, some of who did not see anything. And they said so. Some who did, and they said so. And they described them fairly the same much. There were silver disc objects in the sky. One of them floated to the field and took out some brush and small trees just outside the school property. Four creatures with big eyes dressed in black got out. They were small. And mostly the older pupils approached, saw them coming and sort of stood there and froze. The little kids ran back to the doors of the school. They were more frightened. And this is when supposedly they got their messages. So the only issue that came into play is that Mac would become very fascinated with, and he would bring back to the United States and create a kind of a craze in the UFO community of saying that these aliens are coming to Earth now because they're watching us because we're environmentally committing suicide, okay? So he said that one fifth grader told him that they warned us about something that's going to happen and that the pollution mustn't be. An 11-year-old girl said, I think they want people to know that we're actually making harm on this world and we mustn't get too technology. So I think she means too technical, not too much technology. And one said that the world would end because we're not taking care of the planet. Interestingly enough, Hind never got any such messages when she did her research, nor did the other guy, only when Mac did the research. And what we do know is that Mac was a rabid environmentalist. So did he kind of feed the kids, you know, asking leading questions and kind of, you know, how kids will kind of give you what they think you want so that you'll be happy with them? We've all had that moment with a child. Maybe that's what's going on, but it's interesting that none of the other researchers ever got that information, just Mac. Now, that doesn't besmirch the entire story. It just muddies it a little. We know that in 2021, BBC did a show called Witness History, and they actually featured this on here, including skeptics. Skeptics complained about Mac, you know, inferring the environmentalism stuff. None of the other interviewers that interviewed the children right afterward had that issue. That Hind had interviewed the kids in groups of 4 and 6, therefore the kids could feed off of each other and, you know, create sort of a group, psych out each other, and they start following the same storyline, even though, you know, it wasn't maybe true. But at the end of the day, it looks like that it did happen. There is a reporter, an adult man now named Zaw, who wrote for Barstool Sports. He was one of the kids there that day. Now he's an adult, he's a reporter, and he said, I saw the bright lights come down from the sky. I saw the aliens exit. Other witnesses interviewed in 2020 in a documentary called Phenomenon also spoke about their experience and how it has affected their lives. So some of these people have stuck to this forever. Others, nobody's ever recanted their story. The only thing that's ever happened is there's been people who said, I don't want to give any more energy to this because it's too much. But nobody's ever recanted that they had this experience. So it's a fascinating experience. Again, because so many people saw it, because they've been interviewed multiple times and the story didn't change, which is fascinating because, let me tell you, as a writer, I will get people to tell me the same story over and over and over again because the stories change. They'll embellish it more every time they tell it if it's not a true story. Because they're trying to convince you, you know? So they're like, oh, the lady walked down the steps. The lady in the red dress walked down the steps. The lady in the red dress had on black shoes. And it'll just keep making it bigger and better, you know? But these kids didn't do that.
So ultimately, what did the aliens want?
We don't know.
Or we don't know because it's been, you know, perhaps tainted by somebody's own narrative. Yeah.
We don't know. The kids originally just said that they came up to them and stared at them and they heard a voice in their head. But what it said, we're not sure. Because they weren't clear about it and nobody questioned them tightly about it in the first few days. But again, there were still two researchers who did talk to them, and they're like, they were stuck on the physical part of it. We did see this, this did happen, this is what happened. And they described it very similarly. And it was, but then when Mac comes over, John Mac, all of a sudden there's this telepathic narrative suddenly emerges and it feeds his, you know, fervor for environmentalism, which in that instance you have to call possible foul. You have to become suspect at that point if nobody else ever said it and nobody else ever heard those stories. But it's an interesting story. It's fascinating because you got 60 some kids and over half of these kids say they saw this.
Yeah, how many more stories are like that just we don't know about?
There's the one thing I find fascinating. I know that we have these great big stories that we're used to hearing, Roswell and stuff like that. I am not as fascinated by Roswell as most people are. I'm just not. And it's because it's so well researched and it's been so disproportionately expanded as the biggest story. And it's like the story that proves aliens exist, you know, And it's not the first story of UFOs. It's not by far. I've already told you the Aurora story. And I'm going to tell you some more stories that are far in back in history compared to Roswell. So whenever they say this was the first significant story, you know, about, no, these stories were out there all the time. People reported them, but nobody talks about them. So my next story is going to be a gentleman by the name of James Lumley. And he reports seeing a UFO crashing in Montana in 1865. This is pulled out of newspaper accounts because he actually felt compelled to contact the police in the area and talk to them, and you know, it made a newspaper account. So according to newspapers from that time, this trapper by the name of James Lumley witnessed a strange craft crashing to the ground in Montana in the summer of 1865. He managed to track down the wreckage and inspected it. According to him, to Lumley, there was a pathway that had been cut through the trees in the woods where the UFO eventually crashed. Lumley said he found an object that he said felt like stone to the touch, but it had broken into several pieces. He would describe it as looking like broken glass. And he said that the craft was leaking a dark liquid from inside of it. He said that when he looked closely inside of the ripped craft, he could see parts of the craft, and there were symbols that looked like hieroglyphics on the inside. And he didn't explain what they were. He said that he didn't see any people or any beings. Newspapers would theorize that the occupants might have wandered away, and that they possibly were from Mercury or Uranus, noting that astronomers had been holding the position that there were probably heavenly bodies that could be inhabited. But it made the paper. It made several local papers.
Why pick those planets? That was just...
I don't know. That's the ones that they were focused on at the time. Now, in case that's not good enough, let's go back to 1800, to Thomas Jefferson. Yep. Soon to be the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson. He would send an intriguing message from Natchez when he was living down in that area. And he would talk about a sighting of a bizarre aerial object by a local man named William Dunbar from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, whom he had spoken with. And this guy's story fascinated Jefferson. Jefferson would write to his friend and explain what he was told. And this is what he would write about. He said Dunbar was not alone when he saw the craft, and it was about the size of a house. It was a color of the sun near the horizon, so kind of an orangish, burnt orangish color. And it made its way overhead from the southwest and moved northeast. The ground below it was lit up fantastically, and considerable heat was felt from all below it. Jefferson wrote, this is a quote, immediately after it disappeared in the northeast, a violent rushing noise was heard as if the phenomena was bearing down on the forest before it. And in a few seconds, a tremendous crash was heard, similar to that of a large piece of ordnance, causing a very sensible earthquake. To many readers today, it appears that he might have been describing a sonic boom.
Well, I mean, even a meteorite or something like that would, you know, traveling that fast is going to cause a sonic boom as well. But
that, you know, these stories go all, nobody's ever talked about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's the first time I'm hearing them. Yeah.
And that's the, I have literally probably 200 of these stories, and I'm not an expert by far on this subject. And yet here we sit with me and my 200 stories and telling you, you know, all of these crazy tales. But the common denominator is that there are so many of them. They predate our knowledge of UFOs. So it's not like this was something that was a social construct at the time. And people weren't thinking about this kind of stuff.
Well, we've mentioned before, or at least I think I have, the Renaissance paintings and things that show UFOs in the sky.
There's all kinds of religious paintings and stuff that show that. So the next one I want to talk about, I'm going to try and get a couple in here. So have you ever heard of a British ship called the Mohican?
Not a ship, no.
It's a sailing vessel. So in 1908, off the coast of Delaware, there was an English ship called the Mohican. It was piloted by Captain Urquhart, and it was headed for Philadelphia, when suddenly it was encapsulated in a thick, luminous cloud, which seemed to magnetize everything on board. So it was just swallowed up in this cloud. And the compass was observed to swing wildly. The sailors tried to move the chains on the bridge. Anything that was metal immediately flung itself against the ship and became impelled on the, you know, on the ship that was metal. And metal literally rose from the floor, if you can imagine. So the chains picked themselves up and slammed themselves as though they were, attached to the sides of the ship. And then suddenly as it came, cloud dissipated, everything fell back down, and the ship continued on. The captain was quite unnerved by what happened. He wrote in his log about it, and when he got to Philadelphia, he contacted the owners of the vessel. He explained everything. He said, and this is a quote from his interview, "When the sailors saw it, the cloud, they rushed on deck in consternation. I looked at the needle and it was flying, meaning the magneto, and it was flying around like an electric fan. I ordered several of the crew to move some iron chains that were laying on the deck, thinking to distract their attention. And the sailors could not budge the chains, though they did not weigh more than 75 pounds each. Everything was magnetized. The chains, the bolts, the spikes, the bars were as tight on the deck as if they had been riveted there. The cloud was so dense it was impossible for my vessel to proceed." He says, "I could not see beyond the decks. It appeared as if the whole world was a mass of glowing fire. The sailors fell on the decks and prayed, and suddenly the cloud began to lift. The phosphorescence around the ship and the crew began to fade, and in a few moments the cloud passed over my vessel, and we were able to move on the sea again."
That's pretty curious. And that was when again? I'm sorry, what
1908. Find it a fascinating story. And then I have a couple more very short ones I'm going to share. This was probably my last one tonight. So this is in June of 1914 in Hamburg, Germany. It's 4 o'clock in the morning when a guy by the name of Gustav Verhagen, I'm hoping I'm saying that right, but I'm giving it my best shot.
Okay.
Opens his door of his house and he sees his field is lit up with a cigar-shaped object that's got illuminated windows. Near it are 4 or 5 dwarfs, about 3 feet. Well, think about the contrasting.
Sure. Yep.
3 or 4, 3 feet tall, clad in light clothing. He's stunned, fascinated, drawled forward, and he steps out and approaches these beings. And when they saw him, they went aboard the object. And as soon as they were aboard, it disappeared. The door closed and the craft took off silently, climbing vertically into the night sky. It's fascinating. And when I get that,
pretty cool, actually.
Are they aliens or are they the dwarves? I mean, you can see how he had to put a context to them. Mm-hmm. So there was one last tiny story and I would like to share if I can find it really quickly. I had made a pile of notes because there was just so much. But this was one that I just found very fascinating. This was in Spain, in Guadalajara, in July 25th of 1938. The Spanish Civil War was going on. I have to tell you, I think these soldiers would have had bigger fish to fry trying to stay alive and then worrying about making up UFO tales, particularly in the time frame. So several soldiers would report that they saw an illuminated bright glow from an oval object 10 to 12 meters in diameter, shaped like 2 inverted plates, hovering near the ground. A cylindrical column came down from the center of the plates, and 2 beings emerged. beings walked off, and the soldiers ran to get their superiors. And when they came back, there was nothing to see. But I have found that these stories are just so fascinating. And like some of them just have no explanation. Like we started out with the story from Brazil. There was no explanation. And I should tuck this last little piece in here very quickly. So this is also from 1938, but this is from Estonia. There were two people who saw a small frog man, one meter tall, with a round head, no neck, and a hump in the front of his body. The mouth was large and a straight slit. The eyes were small slits. The skin was brown-green compared to pigment to normal. I'm assuming they mean white. The creature walked in a peculiar but eloquent fashion, the head waving up and down while the legs moved carefully. When pursued, the creature accelerated very fast with feet fluttering about 100 meters before it simply vanished completely. And it takes me back to our first story about these creatures that might have materialized somehow or landed somehow and didn't know how to get the heck out. But isn't it fascinating, the stories that these people are reporting? And the time frames make it really interesting to me. 1938 in Estonia, I sincerely doubt people were sitting around on a Saturday night going, let's tell a story about little frog guy about 1 meter tall. I bet everybody's going to buy that bull.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it doesn't make sense. And yet, but there are themes and currents that run through these, you know, the saucer-shaped discs, the submarine-shaped discs, you'll hear them saying about the tube, the cigar, the submarine-shaped craft. A lot of these older stories talk about the brown-green creatures, but then you bring it up to the 1990s, and they're still seeing them. They're just not getting reported.
I think at some point in the future, you should do an episode on unidentified submersible objects, because there's all kinds of ones, too, that are seen traveling into the oceans and well, large bodies of water, too. Right. So
as I was going through the research for this, I came across a couple, you know, where people on ships witness something coming out of the sky and going down in and illuminating the water and what have you. That's a fascinating idea. Maybe I'll take a little time and poke around a little bit. But so anyhow, that was tonight's episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. I hope everybody else did as well.
I did. Anytime there's some sciencey stuff, you know, yeah, I'm right there. that's me.
Well, like I said, I've been wandering off into ghosts and demonics and all this stuff, and we'll wander back in that direction again, I'm sure. But in fact, I've got a couple. How this works for me is I start working on one podcast, and then three or four more podcasts pop up in my head as I'm doing research. I'm like, oh, that would be a great subject to talk to everybody about, too. So I have three or four more on the way already. And there's always a couple. There's one gentleman who asked a question, and please, about magic in the modern time. And I'm working on it, but I want to make sure I have all the answers, or at least I have a fair amount of answers before I start pontificating on the subject. So bear with me. This one's a complicated answer.
Mm-hmm.
We're also looking at reincarnation, possible other explanations for it.
So okay, that's it. All things to look forward to. Excellent.
So with that, I will tell everybody I have a wonderful evening. I hope you enjoyed the stories, and come back and listen to us again.
Alrighty. You're supposed to get the last word.
Oh, well, good night.